It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This year marks the centennial of what came to be known as the trial of the century. It involves madness, jealousy, and murder. And as with any good story, it received the Hollywood treatment in the 1955 movie The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing.
The world was shocked breathless when America's richest playboy, Harry K. Thaw, walked to the table of Stanford White, America's most renowned architect, and shot him dead with a solid gold revolver.
I did it because he ruined my wife.
Few persons knew exactly why he did it, but nearly everybody knew over whom he did it. She was the model for the most famous picture Charles Dana Gibson ever drew. She was the most beautiful Floridora Corrine, the girl who had risen from penniless model to mistress of $40 million. She was Evelyn Nesbitt.
And here to tell us about the trial and its strong connection to Pittsburgh is pop culture contributor Joe Wose. Joe, joining us in studio, good to see you.
Always nice to be back.
I'm still recovering from that reenactment. It was very vivid. And I'm trying to read. I was kind of asking you as we were listening to it, was he saying wife or life? It would probably apply to either or both.
It would apply to either or both. There's contradicting statements. On his way out, as he passed his wife, she said, "What have you done?" And he said, "I've probably saved your life." But he said, when he shot him, a lot of people say, "You've ruined my wife." And there's good reason for him saying this.
Well, let's talk about this. So, first of all, who was Henry Kendall Thaw?
Henry Kendall Thaw was born in 1871 in Allegheny City. He was the son of William Thaw Sr., who was a coal baron. He had made an enormous fortune in coal. The family was well-known and well-respected in Pittsburgh. His half-brother, is actually the namesake of Thaw Hall at the University of Pittsburgh. So they grew up in Pittsburgh. The mansion is still here. But he was always, well, as his family put it, just a little bit off. He had a habit as a young child is babbling incoherently. He walked with this sort of odd zigzag pattern. He certainly showed early symptoms of, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and he was suffering from a mental illness even at an early age.
So something like a bout of jealousy, extreme jealousy over his wife allegedly getting involved with another man, and it's pretty clear that she did, put him over the edge.
Well, the situation is a little bit more complicated. He had a lifelong hate of Stanford White. He had tried to get into New York society, and he felt that Stanford White was blocking him from entering New York society. There was no real grounding to this. He was a very eccentric man. He had a reputation for sort of just getting himself into trouble. He was kicked out of Harvard for what they deemed illicit activities. He was given 3 hours to get off the campus.
But do we know what he did? What he was accused of doing?
He had a voracious sexual appetite that extended to young girls and boys. Evelyn, who was only 14 years old when these two men both developed their passion for her. By the time she was 16, she had actually been molested by White, Stanford White. And this is before she's involved with her husband, Thaw. So she's accosted, brutally molested by him, and this stays with her. But then Thaw takes it on himself once he marries her as this is going to be the reason for his vengeance. So he has a lot of reason to dislike White. He has a lot of reasons, both internal. He begins to believe that White had hired assassins to kill him. And so he started carrying a gun to protect himself.
Apparently a solid gold revolver, or at least that's what he used to kill Stanford White.
I think that was a bit of the film concoction.
Oh, really?
Although he was very lavish, he is known for lighting cigars with $100 bills. It was, you know, one of the first of those stories to come about. The term Playboy came into vogue to describe, you know, this wealthy womanizer specifically because of him.
Let's take a call from Stephen in Pittsburgh, who wants to join the conversation with Joe Wos. Stephen, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes. Let me turn the radio off, please.
Good. Yep, that's a good idea.
Okay. I'm calling to say that two things that came out of...
Hang on a second, Stephen. Did you turn the radio down?
I attempted to. Now I've succeeded.
Okay.
Two things that came out of this entire situation... that are interesting, one national and one local. The national one is that Thaw's attorney made successful use in the U.S. for the first time of an English law that had long existed called the Naughton Rule, M'Naughton. And we now know this as the insanity defense.
Hmm.
His attorney said that Thaw temporarily lost his senses, but his senses came back to him.
Well, this is certainly a defense that's used often in cases like this, where it's a crime of passion and it's a husband who is striking back at the wife's lover.
Yeah,
and
which
the second is
wait, hang on a second. We'll get to the second thing, Stephen, but I want to let Joe respond.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It did come from England, this idea, but it became known as an American phenomenon. It was actually called dementia americana.
Huh.
So it became known as American phenomenon.
All right, and the second point, Stephen?
Thaw's family was so embarrassed by Thaw's action here. Thaw had... Prior, when he was in at Harvard,
right.
Thaw was asked what his major was, and he stated to others in his peer group that his major was poker and smoking cigars. But his family, even with that as a background, they could try to overlook. But they were so mortified by his having killed her that they donated the money to have what is known as the Thaw refractor, which is the lens at the Allegheny Observatory, made.
Hmm. Well, very interesting points there. Stephen, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Joe, let's talk about Evelyn Nesbitt and who she was. Apparently, she was a beautiful young lady who... eventually made it big in show business. Very, very meager beginnings, but she made it big for a while.
Yeah, she did. Her mother actually lied about her age to sort of skirt some of the laws at the time. She was a showgirl by the age of 14. She was one of America's first supermodels. She appeared in ads for Coca-Cola. To give you an idea of what kind of impact she had on America. Charles Dana Gibson made her one of her favorite models, probably his most famous sketch, The Eternal Question, is of her. So she was much sought after by both fans of theater as a showgirl and also just for her extreme beauty. Artists would often paint her nude. But this put her into some very difficult situations, very dangerous situations, as her mother would often trust these artists to be left alone with her, to sketch her. And the mother was very naive, but also grew very accustomed to these men spending on her and her daughter.
And apparently she trusted Stanford White.
Yes, she trusted him explicitly. She had this, he had this... But best word for it is sort of this den above F.A.O. Schwartz Toys in New York is where he lived. Most famous is his swing, this velvet swing that he kept in the home. And he would act out a lot of his fetishes there. And the mother grew to trust him and would let her stay alone with him. And that's what led to ultimately her rape with him. He was a very aggressive man and took what he wanted.
And despite all of this, I've heard and read accounts that Evelyn Nesbitt loved Stanford White.
Oh, yes. Yes, she did. She fell in love with him, very much in love with him. And the mother the whole time encouraged it. But eventually they parted ways. And that's really where, you know, her husband Thaw comes into the play.
And he, of course, is hell-bent on revenge. So tell us where and how the murder of Stanford White took place.
So there's a theatrical presentation being presented on the roof of Madison Square Garden. Okay, and White takes his regular seat. He sits down, and immediately Thaw charges him at him, fires his gun three times in front of over 1,000 people, and says, "Either you ruined my wife, or you ruined my life." There's a lot of question as to what was said, and that remains. He then was grabbed by the police and escorted out, you know, and was taken off the jail. It was all very sudden, but it immediately captured headlines everywhere, especially in Pittsburgh. To give you an idea, Thomas Edison rushed within 2 weeks. He had a film out that reenacted the entire murder as it happened on that rooftop.
And what ensued following the murder?
Well, what happened is there were three trials. The first trial really was considered the trial of the century. It grabbed
the
headlines.
The first one was?
The first one. They're all collectively this trial of the century, but they continued on. That stretched almost a decade. This trial just becomes a media frenzy. But the family is trying to paint him as this hero who was trying to preserve his wife's honor. And they're also trying to paint, Stanford White as just this filthy, disgusting man with all these perversions. Ironically, the two men were very much alike. They were both wealthy men who spent frivolously and had these, you know, fetishes and perversions. It was very successful in the media. So it ultimately, so successful it was that it became the first sequestered jury. Hmm. They were so concerned that the media was going to influence this jury that they sequestered him. It ended in a hung jury. They just couldn't decide. So they schedule another trial, yet another trial for January 23rd. And this is where they really start to play up the temporary insanity. You know, at first, Thaw's mother was very, very resistant to this because she thought damage of the insanity. She knew there was insanity in her family. They didn't want her, you know, they didn't want it all dredged up. So she tried to conceal this. Eventually, she acquiesced, and they pled insanity. And that was when he got the conviction, assuming he would only be in, you know, prisoned in an asylum for a year or two. He got life. He got life in a state asylum, but he was treated very well. His dinners were catered. He slept on a brass bed. You know, their affluence really, you know, paved a lot of this stuff to really enable him to continue his lavish lifestyle. He actually escaped. In 1913, trying to flee to Canada with the help of his mother. He was extradited back, served a few more years, and then the summer of 1915, they hold the final trial. 100 years ago this summer, they had the final trial in these trials of the century, and they find him, they declare him sane, and release him. Between that time, the family had just paid off so many people, including Evelyn, to testify that he was this loving, caring man that was trying to protect her honor.
And so what becomes of, we've got about a minute or so left, what becomes of Harry K. Thaw?
In 1916, just a year later, he kidnaps and assaults a 19-year-old man, again sending him to an asylum. He's released a few years later. He moves to a farm in Virginia. Then he moves down to Florida, where he passes away and returns to Pittsburgh one last time, where he's buried in the Allegheny Cemetery not far from where he grew up.
And as for Evelyn Nesbitt, I seem to remember hearing that she obviously had gained a great deal of notoriety from all this and went on tour, but it, you know, as she aged, it just wasn't the same for her. She was not the supermodel that she had once been.
No, she wasn't. She eventually became a burlesque performer. That didn't last too long as she got older. She did accept $10,000 as a fee for being a consultant on the film, which we just listened to. So that was really the last of it for her. There was a very little money coming in. She sort of struggled and lived sort of this with this infamy her entire life.
And do you see another film being made? Maybe this was the first one was, you know, in the 50s. So,
yeah, I really do. I think
they could probably do a lot more with it today.
It's a compelling story. You know, with the success of 50 Shades of Grey, that sort of has certain shades of its own.
Yeah, it just tells you that this stuff has been around for many, many years. People just didn't talk about it as much.
No, they didn't. But it's still here.
Yeah, as for this episode, of course, we're still talking about it today, and we've been doing so with our culture contributor, Joe Wose. Joe, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow, we will have another in our series of special summer education specials, and we'll be back on Monday with a special focusing on the end of World War II and the exhibit We Can Do It at the Heinz History Center. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.